So again, I'm Rick Hansen, and it's February 26th, right, 2014. And as you probably know, I've been doing a series on the neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths. And last week, we were exploring some ways to relax the grasping, the goal-directed drivenness that can lead to suffering and harm. And where is she? And I said at some one point that my primary craving, probably my primary addiction, is to getting stuff done. You, that you're the one. And so, and then you said, can you say more about that, right? And I thought, yes, what an interesting topic to say more about. So that's my focus tonight. My focus tonight is our relationship to doing, to getting stuff done. You know, you may know it's, I think it was Henry Ford who famously said, the business of America is business. You may also know that of surveys of people working worldwide, the average American spends more time working than any other nationality in the world, even more than, you know, legendarily industrious people like the Japanese. And so that's really quite remarkable. So what's our relationship with doing tasks? We do tasks all day long. We do dishes. We put kids to bed. We get across a point at work or with a friend. We write an email. We write a book. We make a poem. We dig a ditch. We pound a nail. We brush our teeth. We change a diaper. Sorry about the association between teeth brushing and diaper changing. But anyway, it's one end of the tube and the other. But so we do stuff all day long. And so the question is, what's our relationship with all this doing? Or do we do what I've certainly experienced doing a fair amount of time? Do we go into a kind of trance in which we feel stressed and driven and kind of increasingly numb and sort of awash in some amount of frustration or disappointment, and then at the end of the day look back and think, I know I was working. I know I drove to work, I know I did stuff, or I stayed home and I worked in one way or another, right? I did things all day long. What was it all about? What actually happened? And I think this area where we're exploring and becoming increasingly mindful of, our relationship with task doing, with getting stuff done of all kinds, cooking, shopping, driving, paying bills, preparing our taxes, all the rest of it, I think it's a really fertile area for inquiry. So I wanted to offer some perspectives here tonight, some of them very directly taken from Buddhism, some of them are a little more my own thinking, and then see what you think about it. And as we explore this, I really invite you to pick an area of task doing that's moderately stressful for you, moderately frustrating or unfulfilling. There's a kind of tension or juice around it. There's some juiciness around it. Or honestly, you could pick some area of task doing where maybe you tend to be really on autopilot. You kind of go numb or unconscious about it. You know, it'll help to pick some area of your life where you get stuff done, including caring for children, getting stuff done, and then use that as a focus for what I'm going to talk about. Okay. So let's see here. I wanted to, first of all, offer some perspectives from the Buddha with regard to what he called the happiness that is visible in this present life. In other words, much of the counsel that he gave to people was for householders, ordinary folks, just dealing with life. And he was talking with them about how to suffer less and be happier. So some of the key points that he communicated were, it's okay to try to fulfill your desires, as long as those desires are ethical and wholesome. So it's okay to be goal-directed with regard to getting dishes done or helping kids with homework or building a business or making an apple pie, what have you. It just has to do with, are those desires wholesome, right? Getting through college, learning some new things, writing a paper, writing a letter to a friend, doing an errand for somebody. It's okay to be goal-directed, to be intentional, and to have passion even a potency or a vigor toward these goals, as long as they're ethical. The second thing he said was that we should be skillful and diligent. Those are recurring themes for the Buddha, to be skillful and diligent. So, okay, we're doing tasks. The wisdom is that we do them skillfully, and we're diligent about them, rather than being unskillful or sloppy or lazy. I remember the counsel of Joseph Goldstein on retreat. He said, be relaxed, but not casual. You know, and I wondered if he was talking to me as a Californian, you know, right, about being way too casual. I don't know. But so that's the Buddha's advice. Then I have two sort of suggestions related to that from my own experience around doing things. And it has to do with the Buddha's counsel to not be deluded. In other words, to see clearly. So one form of delusion that I see routinely, and I was just talking about it with somebody in my practice just the other day, is to feel this responsible even though you only have this much power. In other words, if the circle of what you feel responsible for is bigger than your resources, that's delusional. That'll make you upset, it'll drive you crazy. It's a prescription for making people crazy, to make them feel this responsible, but to give them only this much power. If we have this much power, this much capability, you know, good sense, this much capacity, this much energy, and we only take that much responsibility, that's a different kind of problem, right? That's a problem of basically unused capacity. We're wasting our resources. But much more commonly, I see people routinely feeling, you know, a gallon worth of responsible, and the truth is they've only got a quart worth of resources. So you want to think about that and either increase resources or much more commonly recognize, I just don't have the power. I just can't make it happen. It's beyond my influence. I wish there were a good result, but I'm not going to take that on. I'm not going to burden myself with a sense of responsibility for the outcome. I might have a sense of compassion. I might have a sense of poignancy or regret, but I don't need to have a sense of responsibility for what I can't actually do. I can't grow roses in a parking lot. Right? I was talking with someone also about her relationship and the place for trying to find out whether this other person in a key relationship was going to hold up their end of the log. Or to use a different metaphor, it's kind of like saying to someone, look, I'd like to cross the desert with you, but you've got to bring some water. Otherwise, we can't get across the desert, no matter how much I'd like to get across this desert. So I need to know, and I'm going to observe, and I'm going to unilaterally see for myself whether you're prepared to bring some water. I hope you do. But if you don't bring water, I'm not going to set out across that desert with you. The causes and conditions are just not present to create a good result. The recognition of this, even if it's poignant, even if it's sad and soft and maybe disappointing to others, and maybe others are trying to guilt trip us, but the recognition of this means being grounded in seeing reality clearly rather than being deluded. And then the last sort of practical thing I'll say about this, related to the idea of being in reality and not being deluded, is in the kind of classic saying, if you're going to fill a bucket, put the big rocks in first. In other words, I think a lot of people, me included, feel pressed or stressed or on task doing because the truth is we never seem to get to the A priorities. We're always kind of caught up in the B and the C priorities, and there's this nagging sense that we're just not dealing with what really matters most. We often might use even task doing around the C priorities and the B priorities as a way to avoid actually getting at those A priorities. Right, because maybe they're more challenging, or maybe we're more invested in them. So if we fail at them, it's going to be more consequential. But that too is a kind of delusion, because it's really the A priorities. You know, it's the 80-20 rule. It's the 20 that's going to make 80% of the difference. So think about that. If you're going to fill a bucket, put the big rocks in first. Okay, so that's kind of framing. And then I want to talk about mindfulness. It's very interesting to observe the sense of pressure. I remember being on retreat with Ajahn Suchito, an Englishman who's the abbot of one of the two major Theravadan monasteries in England. And he said for himself, the telltale sign of suffering and craving, you know, tracking the first and second noble truths in Buddhism, the telltale sign for him was a sense of pressure. I thought it was a very interesting word. I'd never heard anyone describe it like that. Dukkha, suffering in Buddhism, or tanha, thirst, the two together, kind of in a often a vicious cycle, having to do with a sense of pressure. So watch that sense of pressure. It shows up in lots of ways. You know, a feeling of others demanding things from us or tasks demanding things from us. The way it shows up for me is a kind of inner sense of drivenness and intensity. That feeling can be kind of rewarding in a weird way. And other people may want to see it in you. They want to know that you feel the pressure too, because they feel the pressure, right? They're trying to enlist you in their own madness, or they infect you with their pressure. Or we might do that ourselves. But that's a giveaway. That's a clue that we're caught in suffering and craving if we have that sense of pressure. It's good to notice it. How does it feel in the body? You know, or alternately, can we create a kind of buffer, a sort of shock absorber between that other person coming at us with some insistence, with a sense of demand? Can we create a kind of inner buffer when the thought arises, oh my goodness, I got to do this. You know, notice the insistence, the demand, oh my goodness, I got to do this. Instant pressure. And instead, can we buy ourselves, you know, what Tara Brach calls the sacred pause, you know, a few seconds or even a few minutes, or a little distance, a little space, so that we don't feel so pressured. Okay? And then some practical suggestions about not getting so caught in the trance of doing and so pressured around it. Do one thing at a time. It's pretty classic advice. And one of the things that helps us do that is to cultivate the samadhi factor in practice, the concentration factor. I was thinking as we were meditating here, and you probably recall that I was emphasizing the aspect of concentration in terms of practice, you know, that dimension. I was thinking of Shantideva's very, very pithy teaching. Shantideva was a very, to me, far out Tibetan yogi. He went to one of those Buddhist universities. I forget around when he lived. I think it was around 300-400 years in the Common Era, maybe around 800 years after the Buddha taught and passed away. Shantideva was a very bad student in this Tibetan university. And so his competitive classmates wanted to humiliate him. So they, apparently the true story goes, that they set him up to give a lecture, thinking that he'd make a complete fool of himself. And, you know, of course, he didn't prepare for it. He just, da-da. But they didn't know that he was already really quite realized. And so he sat down to give his lecture, and he just blew everybody away. Right? He's the source of the saying that, you know, the world is full of thorns and sharp stones and barbs. What shall we do? Shall we cover the world with leather or put on a pair of shoes? Right? And another saying that he had that I was thinking about in terms of concentration is calm abiding with penetrative insight utterly eradicates afflicted states. Calm abiding, which is sort of code language for concentration, steadiness of mind. Serenity practice, shamatha. Calm abiding with penetrative insight, vipassana, insight, seeing into things, utterly eradicates afflicted states. So the cultivation of calm abiding, that steadiness of mind, that sustained moment-to-moment presence, that sustained recollectedness, which is the root of the word for mindfulness in the language of early Buddhism, sati. That sustained recollectedness helps us not get lost in confusion in the trance when we're doing tasks. And it helps us do one thing at a time fully. There's a Zen saying. Someone, a great teacher, a Zen master, was asked, what is Zen? His response was, after eating, wash your bowl. You know, chop wood, carry water. Whoosh. It reminds me of Deepa Ma. You may know the stories of her. She was an Indian woman who came to practice late in life after a lot of pain and loss and suffering. And there's a wonderful book of stories about her called Knee Deep in Grace. I highly recommend it. It's very accessible, too, for just about anybody. And people who lived with her and studied with her and knew her very, very well said very matter-of-factly that they never saw her doing anything mindlessly. She was always fully present with whatever she was doing. And she lived a life, not as a monastic, but as a fully engaged householder. Deepa Ma means mother of Deepa. Deepa was her daughter. She was identified as a mother and a grandmother too. So she lived a very conventional householder life in a small, tiny apartment in a poor section in a town in India. But still, nonetheless, amidst all the chaos and fullness of that life, she was always present with whatever she did. So I aspire to that as a standard, to be fully present whatever I'm doing and to keep coming back again and again and again. Another suggestion is to feel the completion in each step. It's so easy, especially in go-go Western culture, to just drive from one thing to another without feeling the completion of it. In other words, rinsing the cup, putting it in the dishwasher, feel the completion of that trajectory, that arc of action. Or in my own case, emails, you know, my friends, my teachers, emails. Anyway, it's okay to send me emails, really. I won't hate you for it. You know, they're such a great teacher because it's so easy to just get caught up in the writing and the pressure, and then you push send, and before you experience any completion, you're on to the next line, you know. Or you're filing papers. You file the paper. Do we help ourselves feel the completion? Or we complete a conversation with somebody. Or we talk, we hang up the phone. Or we get from point A to point B. Or maybe we do some task at home. You know, we go shopping and we're just kind of grinding through our shopping list. Each item that we put in the cart, can we let ourselves feel the completion of that? And one of the things I know as a neuropsychologist is how important it is to take in the good of the felt sense of the completion of accomplishment so that increasingly there is an internalized sense that gets woven into the fabric of the brain that you can take with you increasingly wherever you go, that you're already full. You're already accomplished. There's already enough reward, right? And as we gradually internalize that felt sense, that undoes, over time, the underlying sense of deficit, not enoughness, or disturbance, you know, feeling unsettled, that drives that craving in the second noble truth of Buddhism that leads to suffering and harm. It's also a kindness to oneself. You know, if your friend was busily getting stuff done all day long, or your child, let's say, wouldn't you want your friend or your child to enjoy that sense of satisfaction or reward or completion or even simply relief, let alone a sense of success, you know, step by step, step by step? Well, if we would wish that for our friend, why not wish that for ourselves? And as we internalize it, we get less and less driven because we already feel like there's so much fullness inside. We're already so satisfied as we go through life. Okay, and then tipping a little more into the deeper end of the pool, some perspectives on all this, and then see what you say and think and feel yourselves. Let's see here, my sequence. You know, I've been reflecting on and kind of practicing with the phrase experiencing doing as living. And what I mean by that is that if you think about our ancestors evolving as hunter-gatherers, so much doing was deeply involved with a sense of living or in the flow of life itself, in nature, in tune with the rhythms of the sun and the moon, the seasons, very viscerally engaged with life. It's a sense of living, and I'm living through doing. These days, a lot, I think, certainly me included, we get caught up in doing, and we kind of disengage from the felt sense of living. Whereas if we have more of a sense of doing as a way of living, as simply an aspect of living, and we keep coming back to the felt sense of being alive. See? I think often when we are doing, when we're doing stuff, we don't have much sense of being alive. Paradoxically, you know, we're numbing out, we're caught up in the trance, we're kind of lost in thought or undoing. How palpable is the sense of being alive as we fill in the blank, you know, do those dishes, stack the laundry, pay the bills, work through the tax forms, you know, get stuff done at work, plant those trees. To what extent do we actually experience living while doing? That's a really interesting question and opening, I think. Second is to recognize that tasks are empty. This is a really interesting one. You may know that in kind of the Buddhist frame, the technical meaning of the word empty is not that tasks are non-existent. They're not void of existence. But anything, certainly the experience of it, and the material reality of phenomena themselves, both phenomenology and, in other words, our experiencing, as well as stuff itself, is fundamentally made up of parts. It's compounded. Its very nature is that it's compounded. Our experiences are compounded. Elements in material reality are compounded. Also, they're impermanent. They come and they go. And they arise interdependently. And certainly our experience of things is that they're insubstantial. You can't weigh or hold on to an experience. And so by looking at tasks as empty, in this sense, and you can play around with this. You can break a task down into smaller and smaller parts. You can see the way the task is actually very fluid. Certainly your experience of it is fluid. It's kind of humming and changing and quivering, right? And you can see the way that this task that the brain tends to essentialize as an entity, some static, reified thing, is actually not that at all. It's just simply one kind of flickering ripple in the vast tapestry of causes that is reality. That's trippy. And suddenly when you start doing that, when you think about this task that I'm so caught up in, I'm so identified with, is empty of absolute self-existence. You know, there's an actual airiness in it. You know, it's like unknotting. It's like we approach tasks as these essentialized entities that are sort of knotted, congealed together. And yet if we sort of unpack them, open them up in our view of them, suddenly it all gets a lot lighter. And that which is done is experienced as increasingly empty. The doing starts feeling more and more fluid and lighter and empty. And even the sense of a doer, that's pretty cool, starts getting more and more empty itself. That's something to play around with. It's pretty neat. Okay. Then the last thing I want to say about all this is a little story. I had a friend who was studying to be a Zen priest many years ago. His name was David. And he was involved with San Francisco Zen Center. And I don't know if it's still true today. Apparently it was quite true then, maybe 30 years ago. Many homeless people would come in to the Zen Center because it was warm. And the people were nice, and they would, you know, give you coffee and rolls and stuff like that. But they weren't really sincere in their interest around the Dharma. So David was preparing his very first Dharma talk, which is a big deal. And I know he was a dedicated practitioner. He was very devoted to it all. He cared a lot about what he was doing. So I asked him, so David, it's a beautiful thing that you're doing, and honestly, how do you feel about the fact that many of the people, certainly some of the people at least, who will come to listen to you, have no interest at all in what you're saying? And his response was really interesting. I've thought about it many times since. He looked at me like I so didn't get it, which is true. And then he made a very interesting gesture. He just, I remember we were both sitting on two beds talking to each other in the back room of a friend's party in the bedroom. And he made a gesture with his hands of holding something in his hands and then sort of placing it at my feet, you know, laying it at my feet. And then he looked to me and said, you know, my job is to simply make the offering. And what they do with that offering is beyond my control. It's up to them. For me to make a good offering, to prepare for it, to do the best I can, to, you know, as the Buddha said, be skillful and diligent about it, that's on me. But after I make the offering, it's entirely up to them whether they pick it up or not. That's on them. And I think that's a beautiful way to relate to our own tasks, that we make the offering. We do what we can. We recognize that so many of the ripples from our efforts are beyond our control. We can't be judged by that. All we can be judged by is, in a way, not really the results, but have we sincerely and with a whole heart tended to the causes, right? As somebody has said, you can, you know, take really good care of a fruit tree. You can water it, you can plant it well, you can tend to all the causes, but you cannot make it give you an apple. All we can do is make the offering and let the fruits be what they will. All right. So any questions or comments so far? Great.
Thank you so much for the talk, because it's really been hard to prioritize for me lately. I'm finding that a lot of feeling, unexpected feeling and body sensations, when I do things mindfully and when I do them as an offering, I am susceptible to feelings that when I was more stressed I didn't feel.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't gracious, I wasn't maybe as present, but I didn't have to feel. And I just feel like this really connects to so many things, like we talked about the other lessons on the Eightfold Path and the Four Nobles. It's just like, when you don't feel, you don't have a good experience, nor do that many around you, but when you do feel, you must then bring more metta to yourself, and so then, so it can be great. But I just, I think a lot of the cognitive, internal taking in the good to set up a safety for oneself, and then like some of this other stuff to make the boundary so you can unravel a little bit. In this crazy world, it doesn't feel safe to sometimes feel. So it's just a neat thing to, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, Emily. And also, I think pointing to an important resource that if we are going to try to be more present while doing, kind of the essence in a way of what I'm talking about, that might open us up to some negative experiences, and it would help us to mobilize some self-compassion, some loving kindness, some metta for ourselves, you know, so that we can tolerate, you know, what might be there when we're actually really present with our weariness, right? Rather than just numbing out or getting to what in psychology is called the manic defense against depression, right? Getting so hyped up and revved up as a way to just not feel our feelings or really see the truth of our own life. So, thank you. Another person? Yeah, Lily.
I couldn't help, I loved what you talked about in terms of, you know, reflecting on what you're doing and enjoying each thing. Mm-hmm. But like in the workplace now, and I'm looking for a job particularly, and even when I was in the workplace, the key word now is multitasking, right? Which is so opposite of what you're talking about. And so I just wanted to ask you to comment on that because, you know, how do you balance the multitasking? Maybe you have 50 things you need to do today while you're multitasking. And you know you're only going to get maybe 12 done because you're doing one at a time. How do you balance that, you know, you didn't get 30 done that you wanted to get. You only got 10 done. And how do you not suffer over that? And how do you stay centered and do one thing when you're being asked to multitask?
Well, so how do you, for example, deal in a situation where a job or the world wants to put pressure on us for economic purposes, and they want to lay off on us some of the pressure they feel, who are also being pressured, you know, for economic purposes. In a culture in which, if you think about it, 30, 40 years ago, if you asked someone, how you doing? They'd go, fine, how you doing? Fine. These days, you ask someone, how you doing? Busy, right? And if you're not busy, well, obviously, it must not be very important. So what do we do about that? And, you know, my first honest response is a little acerbic. And what I mean is, you know, it's kind of like your delusional system is not my problem. And what I mean by that, I don't mean you, Lily, your delusional system. I mean, let's be clear. Lots of times we're in situations where people are trying to exploit us. Or it's more like exactly that it's systems. Systems are exploitative. And the person we're sitting across from is just kind of a cog in the machine. But that said, just because they're caught up in this worldview and they're very clever at trying to persuade people to join the tribe and to drink the Kool-Aid and you know, buy the program themselves, doesn't mean that we need to. We may need to keep that job or go to that college or be in that situation, right? But deep down in our secret heart of hearts, we don't need to drink the Kool-Aid. And that can make a lot of difference, first thing. Second, from, you know, a kind of a mindfulness standpoint, the more present we are with things as a whole, the more able we are to hold multiple parts in a single whole. So if you're going to be in a situation where you have to multitask, for example, you know, even a situation like a bunch of friends are coming together for Thanksgiving or an event, or, you know, you're zipping around or life's happening or the kids, you know, just normal situations, not based on exploitative, you know, commercial structures or paradigms. But it's interesting that if you open the spotlight wide while sustaining steadiness of mind, it's harder. But by training and steadiness of mind with a narrow spotlight, you then become more able to open wide and sustain steadiness of mind, which is another way of describing open awareness meditative practices, which were kind of developmentally in practice where we tend to go. But to get there well, it really helps to get better at steadiness of mind. So I do that. Also, take frequent breaks. You know, the bathroom is your friend. It's your refuge, right? You know what I mean? Any port in a storm. Those little breaks are really, really important too. Okay. All right, one more person, then I'm going to invite you into a little practice that was moved to a wrap. Yeah, you, the source, the cause of all this. My fellow doingness addict.
Saying what everybody's been saying, and I'm rushing through all of it. I hope that what you've done tonight will help me.
Me too.
Because, and additionally, my wolf comes out.
The wolf of hate, as it were.
I get very angry.
Irritable.
When something doesn't work right away.
Yeah.
And put me even further behind.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really, and you know, I'm really getting it about the, you know, the brain is in negative to begin with, and then we can change it. Well, I hope that everything you've been saying is going to help me with that, because it's just, it's so intense.
It is, and I'm glad you said it. And it is true. Like, for example, as other people have said, you know, I do it routinely. We make a list of 20 items. The truth is we can probably get to about 8.
Do you get mad when something doesn't work?
Sometimes that does come up, and it's a big warning sign for me that, whoa, I've gotten too driven, or I'm kind of deluded about what I can actually get done, or honestly, I need to be more renunciate, in a sense, using the Buddhist word, about what I throw in the front end of the pipeline. Because all those little things we take on, you know, and we put in the hopper, they're going to have a long tail of tasks. Tail of tasks, a tail after that. You know, it's the camel's nose in the tent, right? But there's a big, hairy, smelly beast that's going to follow. So we agree to that little thing, or we take on that little thing, and the next thing you know, there are 20 little transactions that follow. So I've tried to get a lot more abstaining, I think of it, abstemious, renunciate, about just not